Hello, this is Down the Back of the Seats. I'm Ellen, cinema manager at Campbelltown Picture House.
And I'm Alistair, a film and theatre maker based on the Isle of Mull.
Alistair, what is this podcast about?
This podcast explores what happens when people in public spaces meet, what's left behind, what's been found that's unexpected, what stories are there to tell. It's tales from behind the scenes at the cinema, theatre, concert hall, wherever people meet, linger, and leave things or bits.
And I feel like I should have more bit stories because it's been a while since we last recorded.
We need a bit frenzy.
Yeah, well, I was trying to think, as we were preparing for this, I was trying to think of bits related news that I've got. Now, we've had Christmas, so it's just the volume of bits, really, that have occurred. It's just the usual Christmas nonsense. We had one vomiter.
Junior or senior?
Junior. Actually, I think two vomiters, but I missed one. There was one, bless him, poor lad, who managed to get outside the cinema, but then vomited sort of in the entranceway.
Oh, well done.
Got quite a few things on our list of things to talk about, so we might span over a couple of podcasts. I've just been down to London.
Oh, I've heard of it, yes.
Yes, the big city, which I find quite stressful. But I went down and I saw several shows.
In one day?
Two in one day and then one the previous day, right. Which I saw half of because of EasyJet. I haven't told you this.
Oh, no.
So I went down on Friday in order to get down in time to see Slava's Snow Show.
Oh, lovely.
Yes, which I've seen, I think I counted 5 times before. This is my 6th time. But spanning the first time was in 1997. So yeah, we're spanning over lots and lots of years. And due to EasyJet, then I didn't get there in time for the first half. I only got to the second half. We ended up having to... They had a different number of people on the plane than they had on their records of getting on the plane.
Oh, that's awful.
So we had to sit there for ages, and then eventually we had to disembark the aircraft and get back onto the plane. It turns out, and I called this, me and the guy sitting next to me, we're the best friends now. I said to him, there's twin babies on this flight, and I'm sure that's the problem. And as we were getting back onto the flight, I overheard one of the flight attendants saying that they had accidentally checked one of the babies in as hand luggage. So they ended up with too many babies. I don't know whether it was the twins, but that was my theory. So anyway, so we were very delayed getting into London. And I hot-footed it to the Harold Pinter Theatre and got to see the second half of Slava's Snow Show. Thankfully, I'd seen it before, but I was looking forward to my nephews seeing it because it was their first time watching it. And they are 10 and 12, and so they're in prime Slava's Snow Show territory. Yeah. And my younger nephew is, he's already had his professional debut, but he's an actor. So I was particularly excited to sit next to him and watch his... face of wonder. Please. Yeah. Which was, both of the nephews absolutely loved it. Younger one was a bit confused at the beginning, apparently, because he was trying to form a narrative.
Oh, right, yeah.
And so he leaned over to his dad and said, I can't figure out what the story is. And his dad explained to him that there's not a through line.
It's just a series of sketches.
It's a series of sketches with a sort of
it's Russian. It's what it is.
But they were enchanted in the way that you want children to be enchanted by theatre. It was proper sort of edge of the seat, mouth open reaction and so I spent the second half sort of watching my nephews as well as watching the show. It was delightful.
I took my dad to see it many years ago, and I first saw it, like yourself, in 1997, December 1997, at the Lyceum Theatre in Edinburgh with my college friends. 1996, actually. Gosh. Gosh. Yes. We all really enjoyed it, and the finale is just, it's one of these great moments of theatre you'll never forget. affected my kind of interpretation of theatre so much. I actually did my dissertation on clowning 3 years later at the end of my fourth year, and then I went off to study clown in Paris, as I'm sure everyone knows. Sorry, in fact, you might not have seen this before. This here is my clown nose.
You've
from my time in Paris.
It's your clown nose.
Yeah, it's still there. So I keep that on my desk to remind me not to get too serious. I've failed, which is clowning. And then I took my dad to see Slava when he came to visit me in Paris one time in the Casino Theatre in Paris. And watching his face at the end, I just watched my dad's face rather than the spectacle of what was going on. And it was wonderful. Just wonderful. Complete awe. And someone you love's face is just lovely. It's a very special show indeed, no two ways about it. The other one that had a similar impact on me is Do You Come Here Often by The Right Size, about two men trapped in a bathroom for...
I saw that too.
Did you really? I didn't know you saw that.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
So that's the show that's had more effect on me than anything else that I've ever seen.
When would that have been? That would have been 19...
We are both dead, but you can't compete with that.
98. It would have been late 90s.
Yes, it started about 98 and it went on till about 2001. Yeah. It was an epic thing. It was, the idea is that two gentlemen are trapped in a bathroom, a very fancy, chintzy bathroom for infinity, and they've got to figure out why they're there and how it's happened. And it goes from an irritation through to complete absurdity, and they meet in a character called Evan the Egg. It's wonderful. It's still, I love it.
Yeah. I've got some clown questions for you.
Certainly.
Well, it's more of a sort of broad question about clowning and traditions. So my sister-in-law's question was, is Slava, is that the epitome of the Russian clowning tradition, what he's doing?
That's a really fantastic question. Clowning in Russia is very much a formal tradition. In fact, one of the most successful clowns was a guy called Willie Campbell, I think his name was. And there's a book of his I've got somewhere over there called Willie the Clown, about how he became accepted. So yes, it is very much formal Russian clowning, but actually he's one of the ones that pushes out a little bit more than that and goes beyond. And after that, Russian clowning was very influenced by him. There was obviously went on to work internationally, and a lot of people were influenced by his work. And I think the first person to take over as the Slava character, or the yellow clown, was an Italian guy, if I remember rightly. But at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, where you used to see a lot of these kind of shows, and this is what I did my dissertation on, was several representation of clown. There were Russian clowns that were very much influenced by them, and there was Farsis Fistan, I think they were called, who were a clown ensemble who did scenic clowning like he does as well, making scenes through clowning. But his biggest successor, I think, I forget the guy's name now, but the company was called Derevo. Do you remember Derevo at all?
Don't think so.
They were brilliant. They were so exciting. They were like Slava, but punk. A lot more angry, openly angry. And they did a version of Dante's Inferno, I think, and all sorts of stuff through clown. And they started off with quite naive clown stuff and then went into dark clown very quickly. He is the apex of a certain period of Russian clowning, a formal tradition which has carried on and developed since then. I'm out of touch with it now, but Derevo was where it went after that, and Derevo became based in Italy as well. So
Well, that was going to be my next question is clowning still, is it alive, or is it one of the dying arts that we bemoan?
So living on Mull and not getting to things that I love, like the Edinburgh Festival, too often, I found it hard to say. I'm a bit out of touch with that world as well. There's a journal I got from 1996 until 2010, when my son came along, called Total Theatre.
Your son's called Total Theatre?
Yes, yeah, he's lovely. I was so fond of this journal that I called Total Theatre. Sorry, yes. I got this journal, Total Theatre, when my son Cole came along. stopped getting it then, sorry. And they always had things that were going on about the latest things in the world of physical theatre and clowning. So I'm a bit out of touch, but knowing that Ickle Lecox is still going, in they've moved to home of the anti-pope, what do you call it, in France, Avignon. They just recently moved to Avignon from Paris. So they're down there now, and that they'll be still training lots of clowns. And then Philippe Gorier is in the outskirts of Paris, I think, still, and who Emma Thompson and Sacha Baron Cohen trained with. He's still around. So I'm presuming that people will be still taking the form of clown and playing around with that. I'm pretty certain. You just have to be really good with it. In fact, one of my great heroes, Nola Ray. I don't know if you've ever seen any of Nola's work at all.
I don't believe so.
Oh God, she's amazing. She is still going, and is not a young lady now. She's still teaching clown internationally as well. My dissertation was an analysis of contemporary clowning by looking at Do You Come Here Often by the Right Size, and also Mozart Preposteroso by Nola Ray, which is about the life of Mozart as told through clown. Not a single word. Absolutely beautiful, one of the most incredible shows ever. And you can find Nola Ray's work online to buy as well on Vimeo and her own website, so I recommend it very strongly. She's got Exit Napoleon Pursued by Rabbits, I think, is one of her classics as well. Rowan Atkinson trained with her, so she's a very, very significant clown. Really cool, and just a very decent person. Australian. And has been based in England for 40 years, maybe more. She said to me something which has really influenced all my work, which is the nature of the relationship between the performer and the technician should be as if it's one person, which I thought was absolutely beautiful. Mm. That you are that sort of symbiotic person, that you when you do something, it just happens automatically because the technician's there with you. And that relationship between technician and performer is something I've always tried to foster in my own work. It was harder when you're working for other companies, but if it was my own company that I was working with, it was very often one of my dearest friends, George, who'd work with me, and we would, it was just really special. I miss it, but I don't miss the pish that goes with theatre.
Mm.
I haven't performed in, I think, 16 years or something like that now. For calls 14 going on 15. So that's, I think 16 years. I've directed plenty of stuff, but not performed in a while. But but nice to get back to something that I want to do. I gave up. Sorry, this is maybe not interesting, but I kind of pretty much gave up performing because so many of the companies I was working for were just paid to create theatre, and there was no passion or love in it. And if you're giving your heart and soul to something, you really have to do it. You really have to commit 100%, or else it's just pointless. And the amount of times I was putting a lot into shows, and frankly there was no care put behind the scenes, it's like, well, what's the point in this? So the theatre.
The theatre. This time that I went to see Slava, I found that my reaction was at odds more with the audience more than it has been in the past.
Really?
I think it's because there were lots of kids. So obviously, children are welcome in the theatre, and I'm not going to start saying that. But one of the beautiful things about Slava's snow show and clowning of the tradition that we're talking about, I think, is the mixture of melancholy and humour. So it's Slava is not only the funniest thing that I think I've ever seen, but also the saddest and the most melancholic. I think melancholy is the word. The audience seems to have shifted over the years, I think, from serious theatre people being very scratchy chin, which is not the best audience, to children. It was a big child audience when I saw it, which is lovely because the humour of it really, really lands in a very sort of visceral, childlike way. The kids were shrieking with laughter. At things that are quite nuanced, at sort of just little, you know, eyebrow moves or little looks and
Roger Mooring.
Yeah, and that was great, but not quite not quite engaging with the melancholy, whereas I'm more of the melancholic. So I was sort of, and I think I missed a little bit of the audience just sort of suddenly hushing because it was so sad. I don't know if you remember the bit in where he engages with the coat. He goes to a train, he's at a train station and he puts a coat and he's brushing the coat. Puts his arm in the coat in order to brush it more carefully. And then the arm becomes the arm, his arm becomes the arm of the person in the coat. And it's so beautiful and it's hilarious, but so sad. And I think I missed a little bit of how melancholy I felt during that part before, because the kids were engaging with the funny bits, which is absolutely fine. And it was a lovely reaction. There were some children over to the right of us who were really just, they were loving it, but shrieking with laughter all the way through. And I was, because one of the things that I look forward to when I go to Slava is getting very sad very quickly from laughing, laughing to sadness very quickly. I think we spoke about this a little bit. I was re-listening to Emilio's episode, Emilio Vieira, he's an actor. And we were talking about it. He was in a play called Napoli Milan. I can never say it. I've got to take a run up. Hang on. Napoli Millenieri. I might have got the last vowel of that wrong. And I think I spoke to him about it, that I was, I found the play very moving and very sad, but it is a, it's also a farce and a comedy, a broad comedy. And the audience that I was sitting in, I thought they were very much engaging with the broad comedy, whereas I was very much engaging with the depths of it. Not that I'm, it sounds like I'm such an arse. I'm so much deeper than the rest of the audience. It's not that, it's not.
No,
it's not that at all. It's just that I enjoy.
The safety of sadness in a theatrical environment.
Yes. Yeah. Beautiful. Perfect. Yes. I have the touch of the melancholy about me and I enjoy seeing that represented on stage in amongst funny bits. So, yeah, but, you know, but then at the end when the snowstorm, there's a big snowstorm and then the ball, the big balls come out that you can play with at the auditorium. So at the very end, he fills the auditorium with these huge balls and you just sort of bounce them about in the auditorium and it's so much fun. We were under the balcony, actually, but my two nephews ran down to the front, looked at their dad, can we go, can we go, can we go? And he said, yeah, you can go. They ran down to the front and played with the bouncy balls for ages. So such a good ending, because even if your audience isn't engaging with the play, they get to then play with big bouncy balls for a bit, and you can't go home sad after that.
No, it's really special. It's a there's just so much going on. I must have said about my kind of theory of comedy that inspired by The Right Size and Willie Russell and people like that as well, of the best way to tell a truth is with after a laugh, where you build up the laugh to such a crescendo that the conscious mind dissolves, and then you just put a simple truth in at the end of it and it just resonates so much more. It's what Antonin Artaud was trying to do with the theatre of cruelty, where you present cruel images and, you know, brutality and violence, so that the mind, and based on the Marquis de Sade, and then you put in a simple truth after the end. There's a much more kind way of doing it through laughter. And Willie Russell was the master of this, as are The Right Size as well. You know, these completely absurd moments and that just reveal a simple, simple human truths. Mm. A truth that things that are so hard to write, but just to show or say within a few words. It's just, it's kind of magic.
Yeah, I love it. There's a bit in Love's Labour's Lost that I actively look forward to when I go and see Love's Labour's Lost, because I know it's going to happen.
I've never seen that one.
It's great. Well, there's the sort of the comic interlude, you know, and everybody's laughing in it, and it ramps up the comedy, and it gets funnier and funnier and funnier. And just at the point where everybody is at the sort of peak of hilarity and everybody's sort of larking about and being daft, Markaday, is that the guy's name? Sorry, I forgot that wrong. Markaday, who's a messenger from the king, arrives to tell the king's daughter that her father has died. And it's just such a sort of, if it's done well, I get so annoyed when it's not done well, but if it's done well, then it's just this sort of shot, absolutely kind of shot in the chest of funny, yeah. funny, 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 funny. And he comes in and he says, the king, your father. And she says, dead, I think. And it's, oof.
That's it. Wonderful.
Yeah.
It's very good, that Shakespeare. Really, he was excellent.
Do you know what? I think he was onto something. I think we should look at Shakespeare more. Speaking of Shakespeare, what a wonderful segue. So there are two other plays that I saw. One was The Invention of Love with Simon Russell Beale, which was superb. Simon Russell Beale is the greatest actor living at this time. Fact.
You think?
I think so.
Wow.
Well, he has because he's got a touch of the melancholy as well. I think I mean, that's not a controversial opinion that Simon Russell Beale is one of the greatest actors of our time. But he is just, you're in safe hands with SRB.
I first came across him through radio stuff when he was playing Smiley, I think, in the radio adaptations of the Jolly novels. And he played Beria amazingly well in The Death of Stalin. He was, I think he's kind of the highlight of that film in many ways.
Yes.
He's just so evil and smiling villain, you know?
Yeah. He's a wonderful, wonderful actor. I've only ever seen him in one thing that I thought the production... I can usually trust him as well. I trust him to be in a good production. There's only that Richard II I wasn't too keen on the production, but then he was brilliant. So he makes up for it. Anyway, The Invention of Love, which is A.E. Houseman. It's Tom Stoppard play about A.E. Houseman, and he played Houseman Senior as an old person, and then there was a young Houseman as well who was also brilliant. Anyway, that was great. But the segue goes into... The Tempest, which I went to see with Sigourney Weaver playing Prospero. And it brings us on.
I've read some reviews of this.
You've read some reviews? Yeah. It's been savaged. Sausaged. It's been completely sausaged. Savaged by the reviews. As most things, as we know, I thought it was fine.
Okay.
Oh, which isn't a huge
indication of genius, yeah.
Indication of genius. But I thought, yeah, it was good. I enjoyed it. Sat there. I thought she was quite unfairly savage. She's not given much to do. Her Prospero is very static. She's basically sitting on a stool at the front of the stage for the whole thing. And she moves to the back of the stage at a couple of points and then
Does the production want us to think that it's Prospero's dream by any chance?
Possibly.
Or is it do they call her Prospera rather than Prospero?
They call her Prospero, but they do. All the pronouns are changed. So she is a woman. Miranda refers to her as her mother. She's been the Duchess of Naples. Okay. So they've completely changed that. I was trying to remember. So I've seen two other female Prospero. One was Gemma Redgrave and... Neither me or my dad can remember whether they changed the pronouns in that. We think they didn't. And then also Martha Henry in Canada, who is one of the great Canadian actors. She died last year, I think, maybe the year before. Only a few months after her last season at Stratford. But she was superb. And again, I can't remember whether they changed that. I think she was a man. I think she was playing Prospero, the man.
There's the film version as well with Helen Mirren by Julie Taymor. Julie Taymor also trained at Lecoq. And Russell Brand was Trinculo in that or something.
Who was?
Russell Brand, unfortunately, was Trinculo or something. Dear. And his kind of waffle really added to it. Trinculo
is such a difficult part. We had Gavin from Gavin and Stacey playing...
I don't get Gavin and Stacey. I don't understand it.
Do you not?
No, don't understand it at all.
I like Gavin and Stacey.
Do
you hate Welsh people?
No. I think Ruth and...
do you hate Ruth? James Corden? Is that the problem?
I cannot fool the fucker.
Ruth's
fantastic, and Rob Brydon's amazing. Like, really,
the writing is so good. Anyway, we're not here to... That's television. We don't do television.
Not my cup of tea.
Not your cup of tea. That's fine. The Tempest. So, which I sent you an article, which was a review of The Tempest. It was a review of the first night of The Tempest, where I think she had some trouble with her lines. Anyway, so back to, I thought it was fine. And I thought she was fine. She seemed to understand what she was saying, which is all you can ask of somebody doing Shakespeare at some point. And if somebody is not a particularly accomplished Shakespearean actor, sometimes just doing the lines properly is good. It didn't make for a particularly appealing production, but I think there's a lot more.
I'm sorry to hear that.
It was fine. It was fine. Do you know what? It was fine. There were problems. I thought Ariel was great. Although they did spend quite a lot of time on wires, and then you worry.
Yeah. Totally. Who was Caliban?
Caliban was your buddy, Forbes Masson.
Oh, well, I have friends who know him, but
yeah, cool. All Scottish people know each other.
So. Oh, that's great. Because for me, Caliban's the kind of core of the Tempest, and actually even more than that, Sycorax, his mother, who you never meet. I think it's really about them in many ways. It's there's a sort of colonial and post-colonial interpretation you can do of the text, which I just think amazing. So did they have Caliban being a ginger Scotsman? Is that what it was?
Well, that brings me, we're jumping about of all my thoughts on the thing. So Sigourney Weaver doing it in an American accent. Fine, that's okay.
It's her accent, yeah.
That's her accent.
That's the Naples accent, for God's sake.
It's the Naples accent. Miranda, who has learned to speak from Prospero and had very little human contact since she was a small girl. I think there's a bit at the beginning where she, Prospero asks Miranda whether she remembers her time in Naples, and she remembers little bits. Mm. So she had an American accent as well. I don't actually know whether the actor was American, but so that was fine. So I was like, oh, that's great. They've got American Prospero. She taught Miranda to speak, so Miranda's speaking an American accent. Lovely. Yeah. Then Caliban comes along, who Miranda has said has taught him to speak. So Miranda's taught Caliban to speak. Caliban's got a Scottish accent. And it's not just that
because we are beasts.
Because you're a beast. But then, right, well, then also, when Caliban started talking, I thought he was doing an English accent. And I was like, that's weird that Forbes Masson is doing an English accent and everybody else seems to be doing their own accents. Mm. And then the one that isn't Trinkle-o, who's the other clowny character? I'm not going to mind it.
No, I can't remember off the top of my head.
Anyway, he does a bit where he mocks Caliban by speaking in Caliban's accent. And he does a very thick Glaswegian accent in order to mock Caliban. Caliban, who's played by a Scottish person, is doing a toned-down Scottish accent, who's been taught to speak by Miranda, who's American. Yeah. So you suddenly, because the other clown mocked Caliban's accent by doing it, then you think, well, they are doing something with accents. But now that you've pointed that out, none of the accents now make sense, or Caliban's accents now doesn't make sense, because it's not just Forbes Masson doing his own accent. So I sort of spent a lot of time worrying about that. Then I had words with myself about how I was probably focusing on the wrong things. And
perception theory in action. Yeah.
Everybody else was doing sort of RP kind of thing. Mm. Gavin from Gavin and Stacey was doing his own sort of
Essex
kind of accent. That was fine because that's the character. But yeah, who taught who to speak and why they taught Caliban to speak with a Scottish accent?
May the red plague rid you. I mean, yeah, that's a funny one.
But yeah, that's I was definitely focusing on the wrong things when I was worrying about who had what accent. I'm used to watching Shakespeare with different accents. I don't have a hang up of how people should be doing RP whenever they're doing.
I think Shakespeare works best in regional accents, to be honest. There's a certain flow to it. I remember seeing Henry VI done by Yorkshire Theatre Company, or what's called the Theatre Company of Yorkshire or something, Yorkshire or something like that. I can't remember. It was when I lived in Newcastle, and it was fantastic. It was like it just flowed. It was totally, the rhythms were there because of the nature of the accent. It was really good.
Yeah, it brings out different bits in the script.
The one I'm desperate to do is, I must have said this before, but Measure for Measure is the one I really want to direct. I love
really?
Measure for Measure.
Oh, it's tricky.
I know, but I think I've got a few ideas in my mind. Yeah, Tempest, I love. It's one of my favourites. But yeah, it doesn't quite add up, does it really? But
no, and the funny bits, I think I've only ever seen, I've seen Adrian Scarborough as Trinkle, and he was managed to be funny. But Adrian Scarborough is a genius of character acting. Otherwise, I don't think I've seen it funny.
I once saw a version of The Tempest with music by Laurie Anderson, which was really nice. Being a big Laurie Anderson fan, it was in Stirling. It was just a touring production that went around, and it was okay. But the music was kind of just... that was the reason I was there, and it was like... so yeah, it wasn't the best, but it was okay.
But I think one of the reasons to talk about The Tempest is to talk about stars in shows.
Yes.
So this review that I alluded to earlier from The Guardian, she used her dislike of The Tempest to then go on to a diatribe about stars in theatre.
Mm.
Which I think she made some interesting points, but I think she was quite harsh. I think she was very harsh on Sigourney Weaver as well, to be fair. It didn't sound like she had the best press night. She forgot. She
poor thing.
Was struggling with her lines. But aside from that, I thought, I thought she was fine. But yeah, thoughts?
It's difficult. Sometimes it's nice to go to the theatre and go, oh, look, there's that person. It's brilliant. but then that kind of, you want to be absorbed into the kind of spectacle of the thing. I mean, as a teenager, when I was a student, I was a very big fan of Stephen Berkoff. I'm sorry, I do apologise. And I'd try and catch up with his performances when I could. But you're essentially watching Berkoff. You weren't watching, and that was his ego was fueled by.
But he's a theatre star, so I don't. She certainly didn't have a problem with theatre. So Simon Russell Beale, my favourite actor. I would see anything because Simon Russell Beale is in it. But he's a theatre star.
Berkoff, I knew Berkoff from film though. I knew him from Beverly Hills Cop, which is one of my all-time favourite films, and Octopussy, which isn't, and various and other things he was in. So for me, he was a big movie star when I was younger, and I was like, ooh. And then once I got to know his work, I was like, oh my god, this guy's a wonderful writer, and a very unique performer. Yeah, you want for theatre is lovely when it's an ensemble. That's what I love about that kind of work as well, is it's an ensemble beast, which is great. And it's hard when I went to see Endgame. I think I might have said this before, with Michael Gambon, and Lee Evans in it.
Lee Evans, yeah, I saw that too.
Yeah, I think we've said this before, haven't we? Yeah, where the laugh fell was unusual, because in Beckett the laughs are kind of, they're not always way laughs, they can be, but the Lee Evans audience was like, you see, and so they were trying to force their rhythm onto his performance in a different way, which was really quite fascinating to see. So I am, if theatre needs to survive, it needs money. It needs bums on seats. So if it's a means of getting things done, and we've both seen thousands and thousands of plays. Maybe someone who hasn't seen a play, it's a different experience for them, and that's what draws them in and then makes them go to see other things. That's worth it. It's in the long term, it's worth it. It's a bit of a gimmick, but theatre is the art of show, and that's what it is.
Yeah, I don't know. I agree slightly. I don't think it is a game. I mean, a lot of actors who have just done film want to prove their chops. And I think it's a nice thing theatre is still the place where people think that that's where you prove that you can actually act, which is a sort of odd kind of dissonance. Do I like that? Hang on. Let me just see if my feelings... No, I don't think... No, I do, because I love theatre. Well, so I think that you can... But you're proving that you can act in a different way.
They're different mediums. Different disciplines entirely.
Yeah. But it's still very much the view that if you are a film star, you've never really proven yourself until you've done King Lear or something, which is...
I don't think it's fair. It's not. I don't think it's fair.
It's not fair, but I like. I still like it. I like it a little bit.
The criticisms against Sigourney Weaver in this production. And also, I look back, I sent you a criticism of her in Merchant of Venice in 1983 when she's playing Portia. And it's, you know, it's really bleak. But then, you know, that's at the same point in time, she's receiving Best Actor nominations in the Oscars and winning Golden Globes and what have you. And you look at the variety of her work on screen. She's played so many different things, really, with such skill, from Dana Barrett and Ghostbusters, a simple, quite a straightforward blank female lead, really, unfortunately, through to Ripley and Aliens, her kind of big breakthrough movie, where she plays a vulnerable female again. But then you take her over to, like, later on in her career, Heartbreakers with Jennifer Love Hewitt and Gene Hackman, and she plays a total manipulative rotter who's, that's, you know, it's a proper comic masterpiece of her performance. She's really good. And she, and then I think she's not in The Ice Storm by Ang Lee and things like that as well. Am I right in saying that? She's got her chops on screen. She's like, she's amazing, like, really. And and people I know have met her in the past say she's lovely. So
which is important.
Really important. She's,
I mean, it's interesting that she has seemed to be. Maybe it's just based on this one article, but she has seemed to be the tipping point. Why her? You know, we've had plenty of big movie stars come down to London and do decent to mediocre work in Shakespeare. Yeah. I can't think of anybody now that I've made that point.
Hugh Jackman doing...
Hugh Jackman's a theatre dude. Yeah, yes. Don't you come for Hugh Jackman.
No, but very, very...
There's Ripley.
The car's just gone past. Hello, Rebels.
Because we haven't spoken to each other. Well, we have spoken to each other, but not online for so long. I've got a whole list of other things to talk about. I've got State of Cinema, brackets general. But I think that's a big conversation and one we've had several times.
It's always interesting to come back to it, though, and see how it's changing as well.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's not. It's a bleak.
Really?
It's still a bleak. We are now, I mean, in as much of a nutshell as I can muster, it's pretty screwed. Speaking to my brother about it again, my brother's, what's that word? Management. Well, he was a management consultant, so he's very good at looking at businesses and pointing at things. Yeah. And he's going to do that for the cinema, for Campbelltown Picturehouse, actually, very kindly.
That's very cool.
He has offered to go through some things and give his expert view. But his expert view on the cinema industry is that this time it is in significant trouble. He asked the question, if you could choose between heating and electricity costs going down or Hollywood getting its act together and...
making something good.
Releasing some decent content... what would you choose? And I said, for the likes of Campbelltown Picturehouse, I would choose heating and lighting. Yes. And for the likes of a multiplex, I would choose Hollywood content. But it would be a much more difficult question.
Well, especially with the wildfires now cancelling so many productions as well.
Yeah. Oh, of course, yeah. So, I mean, that's obviously not having films is the most minor part of the, the catastrophe of the wildfires. But... so at some point, I mean, so we sort of figured out, we decided at some point multiplexes are going to fold, films are no longer going to be released in cinemas, and the model becomes that of a museum for places like Campbelltown Picturehouse. So we bring people in and say, look, in the olden days, not quite this dramatically, but, you know, in the olden days, people would sit in here and watch films. Imagine. Here's an example of how that would look. That is a very bleak thing. But we've, over the past couple of years, we have become a charitable entity rather than a business.
Yeah.
So our model is, when the cinema was refurbished and reopened in 2017, the idea was that it would run as a business. It's always been a charity, but it would run as a business. Now the idea is that it is a charity. So getting money in order to do what we do has become essential. Especially in places like Campbelltown, where building audiences is basically not possible because we have a finite number of people who live here and a finite number of people who come here on holiday. Yeah. And neither of those numbers can go up. And therefore, building an audience is not a case of, oh, you just need to find a new audience. There isn't one. There are people who come to see films a few times a year. And the idea has always been, well, if those people came to see one more film each year than they do now, that builds our audience. But we're now, that's got finite benefit. You know, we've done that. We've got people. We can't keep trying to get people to come to see one more film a year because it's just not going to work. And there are people, because my cinema is 111 years old, then there are people who've lived here their entire life and have never set foot in the building. And that is not going to change. So, yes, another lovely bleak view of the state of cinemas. But for now, Campbelltown Picture House is doing very well. I mean, we're in the best.
Yes, I think you definitely are.
Apart from location, and it's a beautiful location, that is a good thing. But apart from location, we are, I think, the kind of place that should survive longer than the others. Yes. Because it's a beautiful building. It's an old building. It's got historical import. And it's got a community who adore it. But it's also, the location is a problem because it's got a poor community, relatively. Yes, yeah. It's, you know, in part. And it has got, it doesn't, we're on a peninsula. We can't even branch out another 5 miles because if you branch out another five miles, you're in Northern Ireland. Yeah. And that's, it's not possible to capture audiences from Ballycastle because there's a sea in the way.
Quite a large one.
But we did some good work over the Christmas period, I think, I hope. So having gone out to the community in the middle of last year to say, we kind of hit the panic button, you know, we're in trouble. The community rallied and have been wonderful to us. And in order to repay that, a lot of the funding that I now go for is to do even more community stuff. So over Christmas, for the last 3 months, we've had food bank benefit tickets available. So every single screening, you can either choose a normal price ticket or you can pay £3 and bring a donation to the Kintyre Food Bank. And so you get...
Which is brilliant.
It's the most... I've allowed myself to be very proud of this. Mm. Because
it makes a difference to people's lives.
Yeah, I stole the idea from New Zealand, but people aren't doing this. We are the people that are doing this, and it's such a community thing to do. And we've kept the Kintyre Food Bank going because they're in a struggle as well because they've got increased number of users, customers, and decreased funding because that's the way of the world at the moment. An increase of number of people that need the thing and less money to do the thing. Very proud of that. And we also did Kids Go Free at Christmas. So for all of our Christmas films, children completely free tickets. This was all funded, so I had to go to get funding in order to pay for this, of course. But it was, the Christmas period was a real nice atmosphere. Because families were coming and paying very little and helping the food bank and bringing their children and we did care home screenings as well, which is always just a joy.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah. And I've actually just got some more funding to do that. So community is the model of cinema that I think works based on the fact that that's what I'm doing. So of course I would think that worked and based on the place that my cinema is located. So, I've got other things that I wanted to talk about, but I think we might save those for...
Yeah, let's meet again soon.
Yeah, we'll save those for another episode.
Can I give you a very quick picture of the reality of working in film education in rural Scotland?
Please, please do.
I just want to remember, sorry to sort of segue. for months, I've been working on a project called Every Child a Filmmaker with the wonderful Interfilm. And we had partners in this adventure who are Regional Screen Scotland, who are among my heroes, who are the people that run the Screen Machine, that lovely, lovely bus, the lorry that goes around into communities and shows. And this is one of the things, is, you know, they're trying to bulk out, you know, find new audiences by working in partnership in different ways. And also the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland, who are a premium kind of acting and filmmaking training place in Scotland, in Glasgow. Anyway, we've been working months to work with young people in Golspie to make a film, and we got a week there with the young people in Golspie, fifth and sixth years, a complete rarity to work with such a really brilliant age. And we got the mornings of the week to work with them, which was brilliant, and we managed to make a film, which was good fun. And it's a film that's very, very much in their vernacular. It's totally their voice, it's their choices. I'm really pleased it's their film. Anyway, had to get the digital file, the DCP, to across to them, but which was fine. There was a problem with my DCPs going across, so they had to take the file a bit and remake it themselves. And anyway, it all got fine and sorted before Christmas, before people's holidays went away. And then there was a rush of press stuff about it, and lots of stuff around this thing. And then it premiered last Thursday in the Screen Machine at last in Golspie. Unfortunately, the school was snowed in.
Oh no!
One child who made the film and 10 people in the audience were the only ones to make it.
Oh. That's classic.
Support your cinema, folks.
Of Scotland. Are they going to be able to reshow it? Are the school going to be able to show it to the kids?
Yeah, they'll show it in house, I presume. But it's like, oh, for goodness sake. All that work.
Yeah.
But the screening is just one tiny facet of the work. And in reality, it's about building that young person's confidence and voice. But oh my God, it's so nice for them to have that confidence and voice and then see their work presented to their community and say, this is what I've done. This is my voice. Hear me and understand me, which is great. But just one person, 10 other people, and a lot of snow.
Oh dear. Right. Shall we shut up? Yes. Okay. Yeah. Thank you for listening. We've got loads of other stuff to talk about, so there'll be another episode out soon. Oh, I do need to mention that the Broadway Prestwick, our friends at the Broadway Prestwick, have got a podcast now called How to Reopen a Cinema. Have you?
Oh, cool.
You're looking shocked. Have you not seen it?
I haven't heard it yet. No,
it's great. It's Kyle, a lovely Kyle, and Cliff Bailey, who is a projectionist and cinema guy of many years standing and is excellent, talking about the trials and hazards of trying to reopen their beautiful Art Deco cinema.
Oh, but I'll give that, I'll listen into that. Thank you.
Yeah, I do. Right. If you'd like to get in touch with us for whatever reason to tell us we're wrong about things, we are on downthebackoftheseats@gmail.com or on the various socials media at, except not X, obviously, at downthebackoftheseats.
Thank you for listening. See you again soon. Thank you.